This summer, I took on vacation a delightful biography entitled Not a Tame Lion, The Spiritual Legacy of C.S. Lewis by Terry W. Gillespie. It's part of the Leaders in Action series. Excellent series. I highly recommend it to you. I ended up taking it from my little room where I would read at the cabin in Clear Lake, Iowa, overlooking the lake. And in the evenings when we had the larger extended family gatherings, I would use a lot of this material for the family devotions at the dinner table. I found it to be very rich and very useful. And what I want to do is, you have the outline with you here? If you don't have an outline, raise a hand, and I think maybe Jordan can get that for you, as these will be a nice itinerary for our time together. Gillespie divides the book into two major sections. The first is called His Life, as he was born in 1898, Lewis did, and he died in 1963 at the age of 64. Second part of the book is called His Thought, and there are important themes Gillespie provides in Lewis' writings. And I want to use this as, well, should we call it church history? We get a little cameo biography of a man, a little sketch. Hebrews 11:4 says, regarding Abel, the man of God, being dead, he yet speaks. And certainly, though Lewis is dead, we know in his writings, he yet speaks. Many of us are familiar with C.S. Lewis, chiefly, maybe, through the Chronicles of Narnia. Ever read The Magician's Nephew, or The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Horse and His Boy, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, The Silver Chair, The Last Battle? Or maybe you know him through Mere Christianity, or possibly the Screwtape Letters. My desire is to just provide some highlight gleanings from Gillespie's wonderful biography so we can get to know Lewis. Lewis was not a perfect man. His theology was not a perfect theology. The best of men are yet men at best. But I believe he can be very helpful to us in addressing some important themes. Notice you have that itinerary, which are the chapter headings that Gillespie provides, 23 of them, and we'll try to move through them very quickly. We'll see if we have time at the end. I want to give a full overview instead of piecemeal, so let's work through and see if we have time for questions or comments at the end. The first chapter is entitled September 23, 1931. At this point, Jack, C.S. Lewis, is 33 years old, and his brother, Warren, is with him, with Janie and Maureen Moore, and they travel on this date, September 28, 40 miles to Whipsnade Zoo. The ladies are driving in the car, and the men are on a motorcycle. C.S. Jack is in the sidecar. There's a biting wind, and his thoughts are dominated by this question, who is Jesus Christ? They arrive at Whipsnade. They have a picnic on the grass, and then they spent the afternoon at the zoo. Warren complained that afternoon that there were too few animals. The highlight of the afternoon was the meeting of a bulky brown bear that Jack wanted to adopt. In fact, later on, this bear actually appears in one of Lewis' novels. I quote here from Gillespie, "To all appearances, it was a very ordinary day, a day like any other, and yet it would be remembered as the most momentous day in the life of C.S. Lewis, for it was a day of decision." Because he later wrote in his autobiography these words, "When we set out for the zoo, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did." So that was a striking day, September 28. But now let's go back to the beginnings of Lewis' life heritage. Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. Lewis, don't give your children that name, Clive Staples. He was born on a wintry day in Belfast, Ireland, on November 23 of 1898. He was the second child of Albert and Flora Lewis. Dad, Albert Lewis, was a prosecuting solicitor in the Belfast police courts. And though he never achieved his dream of winning a seat in the House of Commons, he, C.S. Lewis' dad, was well talented in debate and in oratory, and he was known throughout the community for his honesty and, listen, for his mastery in anecdotal tale. So C.S. was a chip off the old block in some ways. Third heading there, a romantic temperament. As the slanting rain fell outside the windows of their Belfast home, in fact, if there's something that's literally profound and delightful, it's from Glaspie, it's not from me, I'm quoting many things directly from him, was raining there at the Belfast home. Lewis and his brother Warren, by the way, was 3 years older than Lewis. The two boys were the best of friends. There they passed many a long, wet day inside. You see, miserable weather conditions and their mother's fear that her sons might get sick from being caught in a rain shower meant that these two boys spent a disproportional percentage of their youth indoors. And you think of Lewis and some of the Chronicles of Narnia, you say, ah, that matches. With little or no entertainment but their imaginations, they set out to work with their pencils, chalk, paints, and paper. At age 4, Clive Lewis decided that he did not like the name Clive, and so he chose the name Jaxey and declared that this was his new name. And it stuck. And for the rest of his life, he was shortened. He was called Jack Lewis. He loved to read tales like Beatrix Potter. And he says that in his youth he was haunted by, and I quote now, an unsatisfied desire which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. There was something in his heart that longed for the spiritual, the mystical, the supernatural. He would look out his window and see houses and hills, and he knew that there was more to life than that which was merely tangible, like a house and a hillside. He knew there was something beyond. His father, Albert, was totally immersed in his job. Dad was cold and remote, here I quote, "His father's emotional ups and downs taught Jack a distrust of emotions that would stay with him all throughout his life." In 1907, the family moved a short distance to a place called Little Lee, and there was a grand old house in which they lived, full of charm and mystery. I quote now, "It was a huge, sprawling edifice with an attic running nearly the full length of the house and tunnels running along under the ridge tiles on the roof." And if you've read The Magician's Nephew, you understand where the setting came from. Diggory and Polly in the attic. This became a private place of refuge for the boys. In his autobiography, Lewis writes, "I am the product of long corridors, empty sunlit rooms, upstairs, indoor silences, attics explored in solitude, distant noises of gurgling, cisterns and pipes, and the noise of wind under the tiles." And he would love to read things like Gulliver's Travels and Milton's Paradise Lost. His mother, Flora, became ill in 1908. She was struck with a tiredness and headaches and a loss of appetite. The doctors diagnosed that she had abdominal cancer. They operated on her. It wasn't successful. Lewis writes, "We lost her gradually, withdrawn from our life into the hands of nurses and morphine. The house became full of strange smells and midnight noises and sinister whispered conversations." If you read The Magician's Nephew, remember Diggory's mom, who was so ill and was healed in the story, but not the mom in real life, for Flora died when Jack was 10 years old. And lacking confidence that he could raise Jack, Dad, Albert, determined to send him off to boarding school. Quote now, "With my mother's death," Lewis writes, "all settled happiness disappeared from my life. It was a sea of islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis." Devastated young 10-year-old boy. We move now to number 4, Wynyard and Cherbourg. Wynyard boarding school for Jack was a nightmare. Warren was with him. Warren writes, "With his uncanny flair for making the wrong decision, my father had given us helpless children into the hands of a madman," referring to the headmaster of Wynyard. "Within 2 weeks of Mom's death, Dad sent the boys off to a new country, to a new school, marked by cruelty and lack of feeling. Dad never bothered to visit the school to see if it was a good choice. And he would have recoiled at the sights of what he'd seen, like the unsanitary facility with only one bathroom and a single wash basin for the entire student body. Robert Capron, the headmaster, was a man who evidenced mental instability, and he would cane the boys in public, even for refusing to eat in the cafeteria the inedible food. His teaching method was dull. It was just rote memorization. The boys begged their father for deliverance, and eventually he did transfer Jack to Cherbourg. And shortly afterward, Wynyard was condemned and closed down. At Cherbourg, Lewis, like all young men, struggled with sexual thoughts and temptations and the guilt that goes along with that. His method for overcoming this guilt was a rejection of Christianity and its moral beliefs. He was using, of course, the well-traveled ploy of dealing with guilt by denying its reality. And that's what many do. That's why many disbelieve God, Romans 1. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. The problem is not a logical problem, or even a mental problem. The problem is a spiritual problem, a love for sin and a detestation for God and righteousness. Jack was a precocious, if not a particularly great student. He ranked actually in the lower half of his class, for although he was quite gifted in literature and poetry, he was only mediocre in Greek and Latin. And frankly, he was very poor in academics. And realize, parents, just because your child isn't a genius by age 13, it doesn't mean he's a failure. Keep this in mind, especially for boys. There was much bullying that went on at this Cherbourg school. Bullying. Remember the silver chair and Jill and Eustace and the bullying that they encountered? Because he's a product of his environment and his upbringing, isn't he? He was disappointed with the atmosphere there at Cherbourg, and so Jack begged his father to let him go study with a man named William Kirkpatrick. And that was his father's tutor from decades earlier. And that leads us to number 5, which is learning to learn. Old Knock, that was the nickname for William Kirkpatrick, greeted Jack at the railroad station. He was a tall, muscular, shabbily dressed gentleman with a mustache, sideburns, and a wrinkled face. On the way home, Jack commented to Old Knock, "Oh, the scenery here is wilder than I'd expected." And the crusty old fellow shouted, "Stop! What do you mean by wildness? And on what grounds did you expect it to be not as wild?" Kirkpatrick, you see, was a rationalist, ever challenging false and unsubstantiated notions. And though William Kirkpatrick gave Jack a bit of a rough edge that later needed sanding, he did teach Jack to think and to learn how to teach himself. But on the downside, though there were good things about Kirkpatrick, on the downside, he was a convinced atheist, burying further Lewis's appetite for the spiritual. Everything is just rational. Everything is just made of atoms and logic. But at age 17, Jack picked up the Scottish writer George MacDonald and his book called Fantasies, and Jack devoured the book and had reawakened within him the longing for the spiritual beyond the material. The young atheist, so confident in the world of materialisms like Adam and evolution and military service, could not suppress the longings that welled up in his heart and caused him to value things which rationalism simply could not explain. That leads us to the woes of the war. In 1917, at the age of 18, Jack arrived at Oxford. And he was awed by, and he loved, this new world full of intellectual challenge and history and the beauty of the historic architecture. But his bliss was cut short when he was called into service to fight in the First World War, and this was only 8 weeks after he had arrived there in Oxford. Lewis was made, in the infantry, a second lieutenant. And the way the war was going, he had little hope of returning to England alive. He spent his 1 month leave prior to deployment in France with his Oxford roommate, who was named Ed Moore. Now, there, Lewis spent time with Ed's family and came to love Ed's mother. Her name is Janie. Janie Moore, who at the time was 45 years of age. Jack had lost his mother, and he loved this woman somewhat as a substitute mother, though some wonder what the relationship was really like eventually. On Jack's 19th birthday, he arrived at the French battle trenches where death was a frequent explosion away. And Jack did encounter an explosion. Two bits of shrapnel wounded his hands, and one bit of shrapnel hit his chest. Though he was wounded, he was sad, that wound probably saved his life, because eventually nearly all of Jack's battalion died. He was hospitalized in London, where his father failed to appear, but we find that Mrs. Janie Moore did appear. You see, her son, Ed, by this time had also gone off to France, and he had died at the front. And Jack had previously promised Ed that if anything happened on the battlefield to Ed, Jack would look after Ed's mother. And for decades following, Jack would live with Mrs. Moore, Ed's mother, and Maureen, Ed's sister. This leads us to the trouble about God. Jack, after his recovery, returned to Oxford and published his first book, entitled The Spirits of Bondage. It was a compilation of poems. At the end of this time, he wrote to a friend, "I believe in no God. Last of all, one that would punish me for the lusts of the flesh. But I do believe that I have a spirit. Again, we see this. We see this continual suppression of the truth in unrighteousness. Romans 1. Jack soon moved out of his college dorm lodgings in with the Moors. Jack earned first-class honors in Greek and Latin classics. You see, he did bounce back academically. He received the same in classic philosophy and English literature. But he had difficulty securing a teaching position, and while searching for this position, he lived in near poverty. It was only the financial assistance of his father that kept him going. And finally, he secured a fellowship to teach English at Magdalen College there in Oxford. Leads us to number 8. We could call this the rumpled professor. Lewis loved Oxford, especially the animated leisure conversation with the other tutors and professors. Lewis found a group who loved Old Norse myths. And you know who he met there? Anyone? J.R. That's right. He met Tolkien in this gathering. They became friends. And at this gathering, they would engage in fireside talks amid smoke and drink. Now, this little group later developed into another group called the Inklings. This was a group that would meet together for mutual literary critiquing of one another. Now, in the same time, Lewis wrote another book called The Allegory of Love. As a teacher, he was very impatient with students who failed to take their work seriously. He and his disciplined work ethic detested the wasting of time. Lewis was a man who also read voraciously, and his friends were amazed at his retention of what he had read. One student later commented about Lewis, "Give him any line in Paradise Lost, and he could continue on, for he had memorized the following verses." He was a brilliant man. Lewis did not concern himself with fashion. The title of the chapter, The Rumpled Professor. His attire was a bit slovenly. I quote here, "He wore an old battered tweed sports coat, well-worn shirt with a nondescript antique tie. He was ruddy of complexion, radiating in health, of substantial girth overall, and his eyes sparkled with mirth." And someone said he had the extraordinary knack of making a new suit look very shabby the second time he wore it. His lecture style at the university was captivating. One observer wrote, "Vivid images and portraits just tumbled out of him." No surprise, as we've read his material. Harry Blamire says that Lewis was the biggest draw as a lecturer there at Oxford in the 1930s. This moves us now to number 9, the unholy muddle. This talks about the spiritual workings going on in the mind of Lewis and how God dealt with him. I quote here from Glaspie, "Many can tell stories of powerful convulsive movements and experiences which led to a dramatic conversion." And some of us have that, don't we? In our diary, spiritually. But some of us don't have that. Lewis didn't. Glaspie says, "Lewis' conversion came slowly, over time, in several stages." I'll comment on that in a moment. But Warren wrote regarding his younger brother Jack's conversion, "It was no sudden plunge into a new life, but rather a slow, steady convalescence from a deep-seated spiritual illness of long standing." Now, let's just pause here, theologically critique. We know from the Bible, don't we, that regeneration is instantaneous. The new birth takes place for every Christian who is born of God at a moment in time, at a split second. Ephesians 2 speaks of our being dead in transgressions and sin. It doesn't just say we're ill, though illness is also a metaphor used for our spiritual problem. But we're dead in transgressions and sin, and we are made alive in Christ. It's just like Lazarus in the tomb. Lazarus, come out! John 11, at a point in time, he who was dead became alive. But that precise moment is not always known to every Christian. When was I saved? You know, I'm not really sure. That precise moment is not oftentimes known to the subject, nor is it known to the observers, like the parents. Oh, he was born again on September 28th of 1931 or whenever. In fact, it's interesting. This is Miriam's baptism day. And as we work through with Miriam, even over the last few months and even years, Miriam has a testimony that says, I don't know the date. And this is part of the struggle. Have I even been saved? If I don't know the particular date. Pastor Albert N. Martin has said, the precise moment, sometimes, when Christian nurture becomes Christian nature, that's the new birth, is not always known. Miriam was told to read her Bible. She was told to go to church. She was told to memorize a catechism. She was told to confess her sins. This is Christian nurture. When did the nurture become nature? She doesn't particularly know. Unlike others, there is an instantaneous day that they can give. Remember, it says in John 3:8, regarding the new birth and the Spirit, the wind blows where it wishes. But we cannot uniformatize the experience that you have to have this date. Lewis did not. Now, in the case of Lewis really had little Christian nurture in his upbringing beyond only an empty formalism. But Lewis always had a perception of spiritual realities. This is no surprise to us. Romans 2 speaks of even the Gentiles who have not the law, know and somewhat do the things of the law because their conscience bears witness, their thoughts alternately accusing or defending them. Or we find it says in Ecclesiastes 3:11, regarding all of mankind, God has put eternity in our hearts. We look at things of the temporary and the material, the hills and the houses. We know there's something beyond that. We're made in the image of God. So it was for Lewis. Owen Barfield convinced him of the error of William Kirkpatrick's realism and rationalism, which the realism or the rationalism, materialism of Kirkpatrick must conclude that thinking is simply the result of chemical interactions in the brain. Lewis was a thinker of wondrous, glorious, spiritual things. And he knew this can't merely be chemical interactions in the brain. There's a lot more. That's what the evolutionist says. You realize that. It's folly. You see how God was working in the heart of this man. He was traveling up Headington Hill on the top floor of a bus when it came to him that he would have to make a decision about God. Theism, God creating, or naturalism, evolution must explain the world. During the summer of 1929, at the age of 31, he knelt down at his bedside and gave in to the truth that God was God. He knew it before. He was suppressing it, but now he was acknowledging it. He didn't yet embrace the Jesus of the Gospels, but T.D. Weldon, a hard-headed skeptic professor at Oxford, an unbeliever, once commented on the strong evidence of the truthfulness of the Gospels and the dying God. And he said this off the cuff to Lewis, "It almost looks as if it really happened once." And the old skeptic, having said this, this comment haunted Lewis. And it's interesting how, like it says in Psalm 76:10, "The wrath of man shall praise thee." This man hated God, did Weldon. But God uses him like a Balaam's ass to speak truth. Lewis was troubled with the idea that Christ sacrificed himself. To him, Lewis, it seemed absurd. And also the idea of a dying God was a recurring theme in pagan myths. So he thought maybe this Jesus thing is just a myth. And why should we believe the Gospels any more than any other legends? But Tolkien stepped in here. And Tolkien argued that earlier pagan myths were possibly God's expression of himself in the mind of the poets, and that fragments of eternal truth were transmitted in a limited way as hints of God's plan. Sort of pagans writing about a god and a god dying. And Tolkien says, could this not be a sort of pagan preparation for the gospel that God injected into cultures? Or could this not be diversions from genuine prophecies? You know, sometimes you look at every culture has a story of a man in a boat and a great flood. But some of them are really contorted and changed. But probably they morphed through oral tradition from the true story. This is what Tolkien suggested about myths, about glorious truths like the gospel. Tolkien said that Christ has died and risen again. And so, he told Lewis, every sinner must die and rise with him. And 12 days after this conversation with Tolkien, following the motorcycle trip to the Whipsnade Zoo, Lewis wrote to a friend, "I have become a Christian." You see how conversations about truth with people, so effective in evangelism. Number 10, the regress of an Oxford pilgrim. One of the first fruits of Jack's conversion was his publishing a book in 1933, this is at the age of 35, a book called The Pilgrim's Regress. Sounds like Pilgrim's Progress, doesn't it? It's an allegory apology for Christianity. It's a semi-autobiographical account of his philosophical journey, patterned after Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. He depicts his spiritual, and sometimes he'll use the word romantic longing, spiritual longing synonymously, as a voice that employed him to come. He was searching for satisfaction. It's much like in Augustine's Confessions, when Augustine says, "We are ever restless until we find rest in Thee." This was much the experience of Lewis. And this book depicts the quest in his search for a beautiful island. And here, in this book, the beautiful island was that spiritual desire. And here is Lewis and his greatness. For he matured into a writer who became able to explain great themes, not simply with logical arguments, but with powerful images. And isn't this the way the prophets? The prophets weren't always just logical and giving epistles. Bless God for epistles. But the prophets spoke in broad, bold, technicolor images, even using allegory. And even the best of teachers used parables. This was a lot like the way Lewis eventually taught. The 1940s produced his great trilogy, The Problem of Pain, was the first of that trilogy. How an evil world, like in the World War, how can this take place while there is an omnipotent God? And then he wrote Mere Christianity, and he wrote Miracles, the trilogy, all demonstrating the truth of the gospel. Lewis' academic peers sneered that he dared venture into philosophy, for this was a discipline for which he had not been formally trained. We go now to 11, A Voice for Truth. In 1941, Jack was asked to give 4 live 15-minute radio broadcast lectures for the BBC. The lectures would be entitled Right and Wrong, A Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. They were an immediate success. Jack's rich voice, his earthy but educated tones, communicated the same kind of enthusiasm on his subject that made him a very popular Oxford lecturer. The bartender in a club full of soldiers turned up the radio for Lewis and shouted, "Hey, you listen up to this bloke. He's really worth listening to." And they did. The soldiers did for an entire 15 minutes. Initial success brought additional broadcast series. He went on to do a series on what Christians believe and Christian behavior and the Christian view of God. And eventually these lectures were gathered together and published in a book form under the now familiar title called Mere Christianity. Lewis also founded the Oxford Socratic Club, a debating society that pitted Christians against atheists in honest intellectual debate. Lewis demonstrated that Christianity could hold its own in the intellectual sphere and needed not be purely defensive in its stance. And he became one of the most visible public defenders of the faith in the United Kingdom. In fact, later on, Winston Churchill actually offered Lewis a knighthood to be Sir C.S. Lewis, but Lewis humbly turned it down. Number 12, A Tour of War. As World War II arose, Lewis was uncomfortable with the idea of doing nothing for the war effort while others fought and died. His offer to instruct cadets was declined. He didn't volunteer for duty with the Ministry of Information because he'd be forced to lie in writing up propaganda literature. So he joined the Oxford City Home Guard Battalion. This was a group of part-time soldiers whose job it was to repel German troops who might parachute in, landing maybe at night by air. So every Saturday morning at 1:30 a.m. until dawn, Jack would patrol the dark Oxford streets and surroundings with his rifle. He and the Moors, Janie and Maureen, also decided to open their home to children evacuated from London and other large cities vulnerable to the vicious night bombings by the Germans, the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe. And remember the eccentric professor? Guess who the eccentric professor? He was the eccentric professor, of course. He loved the children. And no doubt the Narnia tales stem from this period of a house full of young ones. Just pause here. I have been very blessed by these Narnia tales, even spiritually very blessed. They've been brought into sermons. You look at the way God prepares a servant to bless his church. Oh, the depths, like it says in Romans 11:33, of the riches of the wisdom of the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his ways, beyond comprehending. Who can trace out the paths of God? God, the world war, all these things working together for our good. This moves us to 13, Screwtape. It came to Lewis at church one morning in the autumn of 1842. He writes, "Before the service was over, I was struck by an idea for a book, which I think would be both useful and entertaining. It would be called As One Devil to Another, and would consist of letters from an elderly retired devil to a young devil who had just started out on his first patient. The idea would be to give all the psychology of temptation from the other, the adversary's point of view. The writing came to Lewis very quickly. 31 letters were written and then sent off to The Guardian, a conservative newspaper. Lewis reveals here brilliant insights about prayer and humility and the meaning of pleasure and obedience and gluttony and greed and love and lust and marriage and liberal theology. Very effective. In fact, one parson wrote to the newspaper editor asking that his subscription to the newspaper be canceled because these letters, much of the advice given in these letters is not only erroneous but positively diabolical. Well, that was the point, of course. Now we go to number 14, the Inklings. The Inklings, this gathering of men critiquing one another. The tea was nice and strong. Smoke from pipes drifted toward the ceiling. That's tobacco smoke, of course. Jack asked, "Well, has nobody got anything to read to us tonight?" Tolkien offered to read more of what he called the New Hobbit, which eventually was published as The Lord of the Rings. This was the ritual at the Thursday evening after dinner Inklings gathering, where discussion ranged from literary criticism to such profound theological issues as to whether or not dogs have souls. The attenders sought evaluations of their writings, and it was no mutual admiration society. Criticism was often brutally frank. In fact, Tolkien so disliked The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that Lewis considered abandoning the project. But another brother defended Jack and encouraged its completion. Bless God for those Barnabases that God gives to come alongside us at proper times in our lives to bring a word of encouragement in season. Leads us to 15, the humble apologist. In 1948, Jack debated an Oxford philosopher named Elizabeth Anscombe. Anscombe attacked Lewis for his criticism of naturalism in the third chapter of his book, Miracles. And although Anscombe was herself a Christian, she felt that Lewis had tried to argue beyond what reason could posit. And the attack on Lewis was devastating. Jack was humbled by the defeat, and he later wrote, I quote from Lewis, "I can never write another book of that sort." And this was a turning point in Jack's career as an apologist for Christianity. He now turned his attentions away from the philosophical to the intuitive argument of a well-told story. Bless God also for those who rap on our knuckles and even reprove us. For this, the intuitive argument of a well-told story, Jack saw himself best suited for this. And in this way, he found that he could best communicate the Christian gospel. And just consider the humility of this great man. Psalm 141:5, "Let a righteous man smite me, let a righteous woman smite me in kindness and reprove me. It's oil on my head. My head won't refuse it." We need to be like this. Now, 16, eucatastrophe. This word was coined by J.R. Tolkien. Euch meaning good, catastrophe. Good catastrophe. He says the gospel is the ultimate eucatastrophe. In his trilogy of space trilogy, Lewis's, Out of the Silver Planet, Paralanda, and The Hideous Strength, Lewis presented classic themes of Christian doctrine in new and imaginative ways. He believed that such writings could soften up hardened hearts to gospel truths, commenting on his own surprise that few recognize his trilogy's allusions to biblical themes, he says this, writing now, Lewis, "You will be both grieved and amused to hear that out of the 60 reviews, only 2 showed any knowledge that my idea of the fall of the bent one was anything but an invention of my own mind." Then he concludes, "Any amount of theology can now be smuggled into people's minds under the cover of romance without their knowing it." And by repackaging the Christian story, Lewis attempted to awaken a longing for God by providing fresh images of the divine, such as the figure of the landlord in his pilgrim's regress. This was the figure of God, much like in the parable. The father in the prodigal son was the figure of God. Or in the Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan, maybe the most powerful picture of God. And just pause here. You want to be a Christian writer? I think that'd be a very good thing to aspire to. You want to be even a Christian cinematographer, to effectively package profound truths to affect our culture. There's a place for this, for Christian young people, men and women. Look at Lewis, a wonderful model, thought-provoking. Leads us then to 17, Narnia. Lewis wrote to a reader, "A number of mothers, and still more schoolmistresses, have decided that it is likely to frighten children, so it is not selling very well." But Lewis writes, "But the real children like it, and I am astonished how some of the very young ones seem to understand it." Although all the key elements of Christian theology are in the Chronicles of Narnia, like creation and temptation and the fall and death and judgment and redemption and heaven, Lewis did not want his readers to feel that they were reading a work of veiled theology. Instead, Lewis saw the goal of the Narnia's tales as that of preparing his reader for the gospel. Biographer and longtime friend wrote, "His idea, as he once explained it to me, was to make it easier for children to accept Christianity when they met it later in life." Again, you think of a darkened United Kingdom where the church was on the decline and many children never heard true biblical things. He says, make it easier for children to accept Christianity when they met it later in life. He hoped that they would be vaguely reminded of the somewhat familiar stories that they had read and enjoyed years before as children. Quoting now Lewis, "I am aiming at a sort of pre-baptism of the child's imagination." Again, children whose parents otherwise wouldn't give it to them. But these Narnia stories are interesting. Child, read them. Lewis aimed to awaken the reader's longing for God. A pupil of Lewis's wrote, "The figure of Aslan tells us more about how Lewis understood the nature of God than anything else he wrote. It has all his hidden power and majesty and awesomeness which Lewis associated with God, Aslan, but also his glory and tenderness, which he believed belonged to him, to God, so that children could run up to him and throw their arms around him and kiss him. So it is with our Heavenly Father, our Lord Jesus." Now 18, mentor by letter. "Every day brought to Jack a stack of mail. It was a daunting task to correspond with people who had been touched by his books and reached out to him as a long-distance mentor. Many sought counsel regarding deep spiritual problems. In fact, one woman wrote to him seeking marital advice regarding her husband's infidelity." We'll mention her in a moment. "He viewed such correspondence as a part of the vocation to which God had called him." There's an entire volume of compiled correspondence to youngsters, in fact. It's called Letters to Children. You could purchase that. Now, Cambridge, number 19. Janie Moore had aged. Her condition now was not good. Her outbursts of anger ran off maids that Jack would hire. And in the spring of 1950, Jack is 52 now, Jack had to put her into a nursing home. He visited her nearly every day, although she had become so senile as to verbally abuse people and be childishly petulant. But Jack visited her every day. James 1:27. This is pure and undefiled religion, to look after orphans and widows in their distress. Jack was convinced that his visits eased her misery, though his time was very valuable. And she died of influenza in 1951. She was 79 years old, 26 years older than Jack. Jack now felt a new liberation. His health improved. In 1954, he accepted an English chair at Cambridge University. He found the academic air of Cambridge to be much fresher and more Christian than the hard-boiled air of Oxford. Number 20, surprised by joy. Jack met Joy Davidman Gresham at Eastgate Hotel in Oxford. Her witty letters from the United States had charmed him. She and her first husband had been communists. When her life and marriage crumbled around her, she found herself on her knees praying. She began attending church, and eventually she started reading C.S. Lewis. And she, after corresponding to Jack, actually moved to England with her two sons, David and Douglas Gresham, where they took up residence in London, and Jack would see them there occasionally. During one visit, Jack showed the boys the typescript of The Horse and His Boy, and let them know that he planned to dedicate it to them. And you look there, it's dedicated to David and Douglas Gresham. In 1955, she, Joy, and her sons moved to Oxford. Leads us to In Sickness and in Health. In early 1956, when Joy's passport ran out, the only way she could stay in England was to marry an Englishman. She desperately wanted to remain in Britain and raise her boys there, so Jack decided that he would marry her in a civil ceremony. He was 58 and she was 41. It would be a purely formal arrangement for the purpose of allowing her to maintain residence in England. It would be kept secret. His friend Sayers writes, he was not in love with her. It would not be a real marriage. Remember what I said? The best of men are but men at best. And not long afterwards, Joy developed cancer. Jack began to spend much time helping her. She was not able to walk. He helped the boys. And there, love blossomed. And on Christmas Eve of 1956, in the Churchill Hospital room, Jack actually now for the real married a dying woman. That leads us to happiness and joy. But she didn't die. Joy didn't die. They actually enjoyed 3 years of married life together. Jack had spent long hours in prayer, and Joy's pain diminished. And by April of 1957, she was up and around. And Jack thought it an intriguing thing that he had developed osteoporosis in his bones just when Joy's bones were being replenished. He somewhat viewed this as God's letting him bear Joy's pain. And the days of marriage life were filled with much happiness of a kind that had eluded Lewis for all of his adult life. In his 60s, he was enjoying what had passed him by in his 20s. And in late 1959, Joy returned for her final routine checkup. Remission? But she was told that the cancer had returned. Jack wrote, it's like being recaptured by the giant when you have just passed every gate and are almost out of sight of his castle. She died on July 11 of 1960, and that's our last here. A grief observed. Jack struggled to deal with Joy's death and recorded his feelings in a book called A Grief Observed. It's a Job-like book that very honestly conveys truths that are helpful to sufferers. Lewis published it under the pseudonym N.W. Clerk. It wasn't published under C.S. Lewis, but N.W. Clerk. Lewis was known to send it to people who had lost a loved one with a little note, said that it was written by a man he knew. After Joy's death, Lewis began to deteriorate in health, and he died in November of 1963, November 22, the same day JFK was assassinated. A giant died that day. His funeral was attended by a few close friends, one of whom wrote about having seen Jack just a week before he died. "I somehow felt that it was the last time we should meet. And when he escorted me with his usual courtesy to the door, I think he felt so too. Never was a man better prepared to die." Lewis had fought the good fight. He had finished the course. He had kept the faith. And there was laid up for him a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, would award him on that day, but not only for him, but also for those who long for his appearing. And I trust that's us. We have no time for questions or comments, but I hope it's been helpful to follow along in this man's life. Though dead, he yet speaks. Kevin, would you close us? Kevin, you're gone. Ryan, would you close us in prayer?